if someone came to you with some cryptocurrency proposition, like we're going to make 50% in 6 months or something like that, and you say, well, explain to me like I'm 5 years old how you're going to give me back 50% on my money when every other financial institution, you know, is offering me 1%. And if you don't understand the answer, that's probably a bad sign. Like, either they're not telling you the truth, they don't understand it themselves, or they don't have a deep enough understanding to be able to make the promise. They're hustling you.
If I had an origin story as a magician slash con artist slash science communicator, it would be me in the early 2000s, hunched over my computer, trying to count how many times a basketball is being thrown and completely missing the full-size gorilla walking right through the middle of the shot. Not only was I a victim of change blindness, I was a victim of the research of psychologists Christopher Chabris and Daniel Simons. Their invisible gorilla video went viral, and the research paper it came from became infamous, winning the pair an Ig Nobel Award in 2004. Now, Daniel and Christopher are back with a new book, Nobody's Fool, an exploration of all the ways human beings are deceived and a few ideas on how to avoid it. On this episode of the podcast, we talk about the book, the gorilla, and the best ways to avoid being taken for a ride. If you enjoy the podcast, why not head to Patreon? There's a link in the show notes and drop me a few bucks. It is the only way podcasts like mine survive. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. I feel like I'm talking to celebrities because I spend a lot of time talking about your work, and people will mention the gorilla video to me all the time. It is like barely a week goes past when the famous gorilla video doesn't get mentioned to me. Is that still a big part of your lives? Is that something that constantly comes up?
Because it went viral and had a life of its own. Yeah, we still get emails about it. And we still get interest in our last book, which was named after the video. So that I think kind of perpetuates it a little bit. But yeah, we still hear about it a lot. I can't use it in teaching anymore.
Yeah.
Because too many people know about it, and especially in my own classes. But
at the moment you talk about it, you do ruin the video. If you say to someone, "Have you seen the gorilla video?" Yeah. And they say no, you can't then go and show them the gorilla video. It doesn't go, well, check this out. This is going to blow your mind. And then kind of probably spot the gorilla. So fair enough. So this is a fantastic book. I really enjoyed the fact that you weren't just exploring the research, but also exploring the practical applications of the research on our everyday lives. And most importantly, provided practical things people can do to prevent themselves being deceived, scammed, and taken for a ride. I find these types of books are very, very interesting, but leave you a little disheartened at the end because you're not sure what you're supposed to do about it. It feels like the crux of the books comes down to the truth bias. Could you explain the truth
bias? Sure. So the idea of truth bias is that no matter what the circumstances are, by default, we assume that whatever people tell us or whatever we see or whatever we hear is true. And we don't just keep it neutral. Sort of we have this default that it's true, and then we need to take extra effort or time or some additional step in order to relabel something as false or unknown or uncertain or anything, any value other than true. And that means sort of truth has a little bit of an advantage because being called truth has an advantage because that can happen in the absence of a lot of extra processing. But what that means, in fact, is sort of that that lies and deceit have an advantage because if they get in when you don't have time or energy or ability, to pause and check and relabel them as false or unknown, then you might leave them in there as true. And so the truth bias is in some ways, I think the fundamental fact about how we process information that all kinds of deceptions and scams exploit. There's a lot that builds upon it. You can't just rely on that, but it's sort of a fundamental part of all of it. And one point we make in the book is that although this may seem like a horrible thing to have in our brains and in our minds, you probably couldn't really do without it. Because for one thing, most of what you do encounter is true, or at least there's no reason to think it's false or to relabel it as false. And for another thing, checking all that would just be an endless, you know, compulsive process that would never get you anywhere. You couldn't really have a conversation with anyone if you had to stop and analyze every phrase they uttered to make sure it was true and so on before you went on to the next thing. So it really has a lot of benefits for us, but it can also be exploited by people who are trying to do something we don't want them to do.
I just add, there are very few contexts in which we question it by default, right? So one of them might be you're going to a magic show and you know the person's going to lie to you, right? Because that's the whole setup. And the other is somebody who you fundamentally disagree with, right? And you're going to look for reasons to distrust them. But even there, right, even in a magic performance, you're probably not going to doubt the things that are actually really important. And a good magician is going to set that up, right? So you're going to accept as true when they say, I didn't touch the cards. Like, well, you know, they're going to believe you because why would they question that? Right.
Absolutely. And I've obviously worked as a magician, and when you do, every now and again, you do get someone who decides they're going to distrust everything you do and say, and every claim you make and every implication of your actions, they will question it. And they have a terrible time because it's impossible to actually not to enjoy the magic, but even just engage with it in any meaningful way if you doubt literally everything in front of you and demand empirical truth at every step of the way.
Yeah, if you're that skeptical, that's often probably going to be the easiest audience to fool, right? Because you're going to be able to get them to lock onto the one thing that you want them to lock onto, and they're just going to hold it thinking they've got you, right? And then they're lost. So, yeah.
So if then we have a problem of, okay, we can't trust everything all the time, and we have this truth bias that kind of leads us that way, but then at the same time, we can't assume that, not necessarily assume that everything's false, but we can't question everything because, as you said, it's time consuming and counterproductive. What then do we do? Like, what is the way in which we can decrease our chances of being deceived?
I would say first read the book, and then second, really, you know,
available in all good bookstores.
Well, but in a way, I'm joking, but I'm also not joking. And that what we try to do in the book is really go through a large number of different kinds of scams, deceptions, cons, misinformation, sort of the whole range from sort of relatively innocuous things all the way up to, you know, identity theft and stealing all your money and everything in between, and talk about them with a framework of what kinds of different mental habits and patterns of thinking we have that the perpetrators of these scams are exploiting. And the more you think about cons and scams in a framework that lets you actually sort of recognize what their basic elements are, the easier it will be to sort of see them in the, to see them in the future. There's a huge amount of entertainment out right now, you know, movie after movie, series after series, podcast after podcast, going into deep, deep detail on lots of different scams and cons, but not really breaking them down in a way that explains why they work. That's what our book is about. Why they work? What is it about our minds that make them work? And the more you consume of that, like maybe a book's worth of it, we hope the better you will be at recognizing those patterns right in the real world when you might encounter them in your own life.
Yeah, it reminds me of the G.I. Joe fallacy. You know, the idea that, like, knowing isn't half the battle, that just having the knowledge of the scams and how they work won't necessarily protect you. Because, I have literally, there's a library in front of me right now of books filled with scams, and all the con artists need to do is change the scam slightly and people won't recognize it. And it will be a completely new scam.
Is it's completely new in the sense that people don't recognize it as the same thing, right? But and this happens in perception and attention work and in sort of the change blindness, the cases where we have people fail to notice a change, Right. You can change one actor into another actor from one moment to the next and people don't notice it, but people are convinced that they will. And you can tell them about one kind of change like that and then just walk them up and do another one and they won't notice it, because as long as it doesn't have this exactly the same features, they don't realize it's the same thing. And that's one of our goals, right, is to highlight how these aren't really all that new, right? All of these scams kind of rely on the same principles, even if they use different sort of implementation.
Yeah. So it sounds then like we're not just talking about reading the book to obtain knowledge of how the scams work and the psychology behind the scams, but we're taking that knowledge and then figuring out how to actually apply that information. Much like, you know, I could buy a book on how to lose weight, and it's not going to actually help me unless I actually figure out how to implement the recommendations and strategies that are in that book and actually make them into habits. It was interesting. I was really interested in the way in which you talked about habits as being important and mental habits, because it's something that we don't often think about when we think about deception. I think because we see deception as the exception to the rule rather than the rule, you know, we're getting deceived all the time. What is the role that habits play in how we are deceived?
Well, I mean, I think we split the book into two parts. One was habits, which is kind of modes of thought or ways of going about what we're doing. And the other is hooks, which is kind of the information that we find really appealing and are drawn to. And the habits are really our tendencies to think about information in a way that most of the time works absolutely great, right? Most of the time, we want to focus on the information we have right in front of us. So it makes sense to think about what we've got right in front of us. The downside of that is we don't think about what we don't have in front of us, right? It makes sense to base our predictions on our experiences and to kind of look for the things that are consistent. And most of the time that works great. The problem comes when somebody's trying to deceive us. They, of course, give you exactly what you're expecting, what you want. So we don't tend to think that that might be a problem, right? We tend to think, oh, that's right in front of us. That's what I'm predicting. So I'm going to use that. And all of these habits are a tendency to kind of rely on what we're committed to, kind of to too strongly hold our assumptions as true, or to act with efficiency, right? To really sort of not bother to take that one additional step in question. All of those are tendencies that work really well for us to sort of get around in the world without having to constantly doubt everything. It's just that we're at risk when somebody tries to hijack them from us.
There is that assumption that, yes, because our instincts, for want of a better word, are going to let us down, that we should ignore our instincts and we should focus on our reason and logic, classic thinking fast and slow sort of dichotomy. But it sounds like what you're saying is what we should actually, we should be doing that logical, reasonable thinking, but that's not necessarily the end goal. It sounds like the end goal is to actually almost retrain your instincts so that you automatically think about things in a way that is more helpful and more useful, as opposed to sort of stopping yourself and going through this very arduous process of reason.
I'm not sure that we can completely overcome sort of tendencies that we have, because they work really well most of the time. I think the real key is understanding when we should, right? So when should we stop and say, oh, okay, I've just been handed exactly what I wanted. Maybe I should question that, especially if it matters, right? It's that taking that extra step, not just accepting it as truth, but taking that extra step and saying, might this be false, right? Might this be a lie? And knowing when to do that and when not to, recognizing when you are using these sort of shortcuts.
So the question is then, when do we do that? Should I be trusting you right now, or should I be accepting that your credentials are enough to trust you? What are the situations in which we should be starting to question things?
I think there are no easy rules that answer that question, but I mean, we are on a video call right now, although I guess this is only going to be released as audio, but we are on a video call, and you know, video evidence is pretty impressive to most people. You probably saw us here and you said, these look like the right guys, right? Like I've seen pictures of them before. Like they, you know,
You've got a lot of books behind you.
Got,
that tells
we've got
me that
various
I can
signs
you.
Of credibility. Like we look like smart guys, researchers, you know, we look like the guys whose pictures came with the, you know, the publicity materials. But there are plenty of scams, right, where people have tried to supply exactly that. I mean, one that we talk about a little bit in the book is, you know, one where people impersonated the defense minister of France. And went so far as to arrange Skype calls with a camera, you know, pointed at this guy who was wearing a very elaborate prosthetic mask that had been apparently like purchased from experts from, you know, the entertainment industry or something like that. It wasn't just some gag thing you buy in the store. Well, probably you don't buy the French defense minister like at the Halloween costume store, right? But they had created a custom mask and they had this sort of setup behind them, and they went to great lengths to really, you know, to really deceive people. Nonetheless, in one of those video calls and the way the scam worked was they would basically call wealthy business people or other wealthy people in Europe and especially French people and try to get them to donate money allegedly to support rescuing French hostages who were being held like in Syria by ISIS or something like that. But the sending the money would require wiring it to some bank account where it never went anywhere near the French government and so on. It was a total scam. And, one of the people who was, you know, on the verge of maybe sending like 50,000 euros in or something like that, friend of his came in to the room and saw what was going on and immediately thought it was a scam. So although and he hadn't really been on the whole call and so on, he just looked at it and said, this doesn't look right. You know, this, so part of, I think what we're trying to get readers to do in the book is start to develop that intuition for, you know, when things don't look right. And one of the ways you can do that is by thinking about our suggestions of questions to ask, you know, like for example, what's missing? What am I assuming that maybe I shouldn't be assuming? All of these things, we go through a lot of them in the book, as you mentioned, practical advice, but they're really sort of things you can, you know, think about and start to get a sense for, you know, when you're in a bad neighborhood, when you've gone off the route or something like that. It's not easy. I don't think we can pretend that, you know, there's five easy rules, you know, and this will make you scam proof or something like that. But I think over time you will become, you know, less deceivable in that way.
Just amplify one thing that, you know, when somebody's calling you up and asking for 50,000 euros or 1 million euros, you probably want to question that, right? If somebody's trying to sell you fine art, they might go to a huge amount of effort to fake it, right? Because selling that one painting to them is going to be worth a lot. Even if it's exactly what you wanted, you should be really rigorous about how you check about it. For us to fake being on your show, there's really not a whole lot of financial stake involved there. So it's probably not worth the effort to check, right? Unless it would have ramifications for your reputation or something like that, but you wouldn't generally want to bother, right? So I think that's part of it as well, is figuring out when does it actually matter? When am I likely to be at risk? And when does it not? And there are going to be huge individual differences in that, right? Some people really are going to set a very low threshold. I just don't want to lose out. I don't want to be fooled. And other people are going to be much more tolerant of it and not worry as much. And that's fine, right? That's why there's no one rule that will just fix it for everybody. But kind of calibrating yourself and knowing when you should be checking for your own sort of personal edification is kind of the key.
Yeah. It reminds me of the InfoSec there and people involved in cybersecurity, is that their goal is never to say that all computers and all systems should be completely unhackable, because that's impossible, but instead to essentially make it so that it's not worth the effort to break into your computer. You know, if they need to spend a huge amount of effort to break into your laptop to get your family photographs, then you know, they're not going to bother. And so it's a matter of sort of saying, what is, as you said, like, what is at risk, and therefore what, how many of these strategies am I going to put into place? Just quickly though, like if it turned out you guys were, like, I don't know, deep fakes and you were scamming me, it would definitely affect my reputation, but I feel like it would be a great publicity move for me. Like if I
got, great for us too.
You know what I mean? It would be, I'd be amazing. Absolutely. Yeah. Let's do this. Let's get a rubber mask and let's.
I've got bad news for you, which is we're not. We're not Christopher Shabri and Dan Simons after all.
Yeah, I pull up the mask and it's Tom Cruise. Exactly. Yeah, Mission Impossible stuff. Yeah, I remember when the Le Drian story hit a couple of years ago, and reading the story and go, wow, what an amazing mask, and then looking at the picture of the prosthetic mask, and it is a blurry photograph, but it's unconvincing to me, particularly side by side with a photograph of the real guy. It not only doesn't look like him, but it looks very artificial.
I think there's a good,
but if
you don't know you're being scammed, right, and you see someone who looks kind of like the guy you think you've been talking to all this time, that's satisfying your expectations, right? Like the guy who came on didn't look completely different. And I believe they had set up the camera so he was sitting a little bit far away and so on, right? So they had some excuses for sort of the poor mask quality. Well, it's like the call has low bandwidth or he's a little far away from the camera or whatever, right? But it's enough information to satisfy your expectations, right? And one of the questions we advise asking is, did I predict this, right? Well, that's exactly what you predicted. You predicted there would be some guy who looks like Le Drian, you know, talking on the other end of the Skype call. They didn't do video Skype calls all the time, right? But I think at some critical times, right, they introduced that element in order to keep on pushing, you know, the whole thing forward with particular victims. And it relied on the idea of expectations that we talk about in the first part of the book.
And there's also the case that, you know, people's photographs don't often look like them. And if you go to any academic website, you can be guaranteed that the photos of the professors on that website are at least 10 years out of date. Often much more. I mean, you see people who look like they're 40 and they're actually 70. And yeah.
It's like.
Yeah. And also me in my publicity photographs versus me, you know, first thing in the morning here in Australia, it's a very different look. I look a lot rougher this morning than I do in my very slick.
I think that's exactly the key, right? Is that you go in sort of expecting things, but if it's set up, I mean, and any performer who's kind of deceiving people knows this too, right? As long as you set it up plausibly, right, then if people don't have a reason to question that, or even if they do somewhat question it, they're still going to be thinking, oh, okay, this is, you know, here's this person presenting themselves as this famous person, and they kind of look like them, and how would they fake a video, right? If they were going to fake me out, why would they appear on video? It just makes it that much more plausible. They're just expecting it to be true, right? And if they don't question it that way, if they don't look at it and say, wait a second, you know, if they were trying to bluff me out of €1 million, this is something they might try.
Yeah. So it sounds then it's not just then, I mean, what the con artist is doing, because I mean, in the Le Drian case, they didn't just hop on Skype and say, let's go. Hey, I'm the guy. There were weeks, months of phone calls and letters, and they spoke to other people first and had meetings. And so all of that is about, I mean, it's a little bit of the, you know, frog in the water, I imagine, of just slowly rising the temperature and the frog doesn't notice, you know, that it's boiling, that old metaphor. But also it is about establishing expectations so that when you're presented with the person, they're establishing an expectation and then they're meeting that expectation and getting close enough to it that people will trust. Yeah.
I think that's part of it. And also there's one of the other principles we talk about in the book is familiarity. So like over these long cons, you're sort of building up familiarity as well as expectations, right? You hear the same voices, you talk about the same things, you know, and so on. I think even things like the Nigerian email scam, you know, the famous Nigerian email scam where you get this wacky email with all kinds of typos, you know, wanting to have help recovering a fortune. I think a lot of the people who have been victimized by this, it takes them a long time before they start sending money. You know, they don't send money right away, right? They spend weeks or months before they actually send money. And part of what's being built up there is some kind of relationship, some kind of familiarity with the people you're dealing with.
Same thing with romance scams. It's building up that sort of familiarity. Yeah. along with the desire, the hope.
Reminds me of the affinity fraud, where you scam someone who looks like you or who is the member of the same group as you, or is it has you, some there is something familiar about them, so that they don't have to build up the familiarity because you, the person that you just met, is like you, and so because of that,
there's an assumed comfort level that somebody who's like this, who's like me, wouldn't cheat me.
Yes, which is even more evidence that you guys are scamming me, because we're just three middle-aged guys.
I've got my beard over there. I forgot to wear it.
But yeah. You tried the beards on and you thought it was a bit.
If I had my beard on, I'd already have 10,000 of your Australian dollars by now.
That's it. You're gonna have to work. Work a little harder. That's right. Let's talk about efficiency when it comes to the way in which we look for information. That was a new concept, something that I wasn't familiar with. So what does the role in efficiency play in how we're deceived?
Well, I think efficiency is it's sort of like a least effort principle. Like, we want to sort of do the least that we need to do in order to achieve our goals. Explains a lot of why we make decisions with relatively little information, or at least it describes the fact that we make many decisions with relatively little information. And in fact, most decisions we can make with very little information or almost no information. But some decisions we should be a lot less efficient, and we should slow things down and do what we call asking more questions. So in the chapter on efficiency, we say sort of the solution to efficiency is to ask the solution to our habit of efficiency and our desire to make decisions quickly is to ask more questions, or even just one more question. Sometimes it really takes just one more question. And it's not that much more inefficient to ask one question, but sometimes there's a lot of sort of social inhibition. You don't want to be, that guy who asks, is this really on the up and up? Do you really have such and such? One of my favorite stories, which is not in the book, but which I learned recently, is that there's a famous cryptocurrency company called FTX, which is now in bankruptcy proceedings, and its executives and founders are under investigation and indictment and so on. And they had, while in their heyday, they had gotten a lot of celebrities to endorse them. There's an article about how one celebrity who didn't fall into the trap of endorsing them was Taylor Swift. And the reason why is that Taylor Swift said something like, before signing the endorsement contract, said something like, are you guys offering unregistered securities? And once you ask a question like that, of a putative financial exchange that wants you to endorse it and so on, they can lie, or you can get the answer that, is going to tell you not to be involved with this. And it's kind of interesting that so many people and their, advisors and so on didn't ask that question, or at least didn't process the answer in the right way. But I have a feeling didn't really even seriously ask it. Sometimes just one more question is what happens. And in the case of Bernie Madoff, a lot of people didn't invest with Bernie Madoff. We don't hear too much about them. We hear a lot about the victims, the poor people who did invest and lost a lot of money. People who didn't invest often asked just one or two questions about how his business worked, and questions that he didn't want to answer, couldn't answer, refused to answer. And then they managed to walk away. And it's amazing how I think with how limited information and how much speed sometimes we make such big decisions like those.
Yeah. And there's another angle to this, which is that a lot of times people who are trying to be honest, they're not trying to con us, don't actually understand the workings of their own thing, right? So and if you ask them one more question, they can't answer because they literally don't know, right? They don't really understand how it's working or how it's supposed to work. Often they'll come back with some empty response like, it's best practice, or, we did our due diligence. It's like, what does that even mean? Right? What have you actually done?
Yeah.
So those sorts of empty responses are often reassuring, if you're not thinking critically about it, but all you have to do is say, okay, what was your due diligence? It's like, because if they've done it, they should be able to tell you what it was. And more often than not, it turns out to be nothing.
I find people who say, I don't know, I find that very reassuring. You know, if you're talking to the doctor about what's wrong and you say, oh, you know, could it be this or what's going on with this? And the doctor says, I don't know. I find that, ah, great, good. That means I can trust the things that you told me because you're quite happy to tell me that you don't have that information. I think a lot of people, when we talk about questioning, they think about it as interrogating, the idea of that we should poking people in the chest and demanding evidence and trying to catch them out in a lie or to be aggressive, like we're prosecuting them. But I heard it, someone described it as instead of being questioning, they said to sort of approach it with a sense of childlike curiosity.
Keep being a 3-year-old kid and ask why over and over again. Yeah,
why? Yeah.
I think that's a great point. If you had someone came to you with some cryptocurrency proposition, like we're going to make 50% in 6 months or something like that, and you say, well, explain to me like I'm 5 years old how you're going to, you know, give me back 50% on my money when every other financial institution, you know, is offering me 1% or 2% or something like that. And if you don't understand the answer, right, after a couple of questions, right, that is probably a bad sign, right? Either they're not telling you the truth, they don't understand it themselves, or they don't have a deep enough understanding to be able to make the promise, right? Like they are making the promise without really understanding, you know, how they're going to get from here to there. They're hustling you some way or another.
Yeah. And I guess that can also work with your internal dialogue as well, is to ask yourself the questions that a child would ask to ask. I think Richard Feynman, that was one of his techniques for figuring out exactly what you know, is to imagine you're explaining something to a child and you're not allowed to use long words. You can only use very simple language and to very quickly figure out what's
I use that in my teaching all the time when I'm teaching our undergraduate honor students. I know that they can explain it to me because I have the background to understand it, but I have them try and explain it to their 10-year-old sibling. Right. And if they can't do that, then they don't understand it well enough yet. Yeah.
Let's talk about gullibility, because reading the book, it's very clear that you're saying that everyone's brains work in a similar way and we're all open to this type of manipulation in different ways. Does that mean then that there is no such thing as gullibility, that you can't really be a sucker and it's just a case of the con artist or the swindler is just flicking the right switches at the right time? Or are there just some people who are more
there
likely
is
to be?
A sense in which there's some individual variation in how gullible we are, but it's not the important point to worry about, I think, like as a practical matter. Like you shouldn't try to convince yourself that you're not gullible and the victims of Bernie Madoff, for example, they were all gullible. Or all the, you know, wealthy, you know, educated people who sent money to, you know, Le Drian and, you know, and so on, that there's some difference between you and all of those people that makes you invulnerable. Like that's not the right lens to look at this with, because then you'll really expose yourself to a lot, I think, if you go through thinking, you know, too highly of yourself that way. You might be a little less gullible, you know, than other people. You might be a little more discerning and like detecting bullshit, for example, versus accepting it. But the key thing is that, you know, the good scammers, like they will figure out something that works for you. Because a good scam or a good con is sort of based on what the victim, you know, believes, what they're assuming, what they're expecting, you know, what information they're paying attention to and not. And all of those things are human universals pretty much as far as we know. Right? You can craft something that's going to work for anyone. It might be harder for some people than others, but that's the key thing. There's always something waiting for everybody somewhere.
And I'd say it's undoubtedly harder for some people than others, right? Some people are going to be much more skeptical. If you're trying to fool a professional magician with a magic trick, they're going to have a lot of guesses about how you're doing it. And they may not be right, but they're going to approach it in a completely different way because they have a lot more experience. And the same is true for all of us, right? There are going to be some contexts in which we know to be skeptical, right? And there are going to be others in which we're likely to be gullible or likely to fall for something if it's framed in just the right way that matches our desires, meets with our sort of habits and hooks us with the information we want. Then we all can be subject to this. And I think that's really the key point here, is that we can't assume that other people are gullible because they fell for something. You know, yes, they might be, but you might be under the right conditions too.
Yeah. So it's almost as if different everyone has their own different ways in which they are more likely to be deceived. And just because, say, I wouldn't fall for Bernie Madoff scam doesn't mean I wouldn't fall for a romance scam. You know, just for a more simple example.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, a lot of the scams that work right now are very much targeted, right? So a lot of the call center scams that are based on reaching out to people who are maybe in a country illegally and pretend to be from the, you know, immigration services, or somebody who might be financially struggling and they know that, they might pretend to be from the tax services, right? Whereas if you know that you've paid all your taxes and you know that you're a citizen of the country you're in, those are not going to be very effective on you.
Yeah. So it's something I hadn't considered, that this information is out there, and you know, obviously there's information that is out there about me that it's not necessarily my bank account details and my passport number, but it could be the fact that I'm self-employed, my age, my you know, maybe the types of things that I'm interested in, and a con artist can use that information to create a custom scam.
Whether
I think they call it spear phishing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, this can be very bespoke, like in the famous Theranos case. Well, where, you know, sort of Elizabeth Holmes, the you know, the founder of Theranos, famously just went to prison very recently as we're recording this finally. She crafted some of her messages, you know, very specifically when she was trying to attract investors who had, you know, family histories of people who suffered certain diseases and illnesses and so on. She would talk about how, you know, cancer testing, you know, was possible with her, you know, with her diagnostic test machine and so on. And I think there's a lot of evidence that, you know, she looked into that, or at least acquired some information even about that kind of, you know, about that kind of thing. Psychics, for example, you know, who do the so-called cold readings, you know, in front of an audience, right? Often they have, you know, themselves or people who have sort of looked up some information about you beforehand, but yet they pretend to know nothing about you but what's coming out of your mouth right at that moment, right? So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of information out there about us, and people may use it, you know, people may use it against us for sort of harmless entertainment or relatively harmless entertainment, or for something much, much, much worse.
And that ties into the chapter on precision, you know, the idea that this, the more precise information is, and more detailed information is, the more likely we are to accept it as true. And that uncertainty and vagueness are sort of seen as untrustworthy. Is there an evolutionary or a neurological reason why we think that way?
Well, it actually makes a lot of sense, right? That if somebody genuinely has precise details, right? So if they actually have a really good model of reality and they can give you a really precise answer, that means they have a good understanding, right? So going one direction, great understanding does lead to precise information. And the problem is when you assume if somebody's giving you precise information, you kind of assume that there's a causal connection there, that they actually have a deep understanding when they might just be faking it, right? So they're taking advantage of the fact that when something's truly precise, it's often a sign of good, right? It's often a sign that it's valid. And we're just misusing that when somebody's trying to use that information against us.
I was filming a TV series about scams, and during the lunch break, one of the cameramen was approached by do you have the white van scammers in the US?
It's some kind of meme that there are these white vans all over the place, and like, you know, they'll kidnap kids into the white vans.
Oh,
or something.
No,
like,
oh,
that.
That's a different one.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a different one. Okay, so the white vans in Australia are different, huh?
Here, yeah, the white vans are, yeah, the serial killer van.
Yeah,
contractor or serial killer.
Free candy, yeah, scrawled on the side of the van, yeah, and the kids, yeah, run in. And I would run in. I'd 100%. Yeah, if you got candy, I'm there. No, this is a scam. It's basically they drive around in a van and they have high end electronics for sale that they sell out of the back of the van. And the implication is maybe they're stolen, or maybe like, oh, this is left over from a job, and it's a little bit sketchy. And so we're shooting this show, and the show is about scams. And I watched, and the cameraman was talking to a guy with a white van, and we were planning an episode about the white van scam. And I walked up, and the guy was had launched into this extraordinarily intricate sales pitch. It wasn't just, I've got some high-priced electronics. He had the brands. He was talking about frequencies of the wireless. And the cameraman handed over money. Right then, boom, got the speakers and got scammed. But as you said, that level of precision, it wasn't just, hey, you want to buy some speakers, a sound system. It was, do you want to buy the X2? So
that reminds me quite a bit of a scam, or at least a sales practice that we actually did talk about in the book, which is selling supposed collectible artworks in improbable venues, like on cruise ships or on late night infomercials or something like that. And you know, if you think like, well, who would ever buy a Picasso on a cruise ship or off of a TV show, you're not the audience for that scam, right? So, you know, crazy, improbable scams probably have a different audience from you. Can't say anything about your camera, you know, your camera operator or anything like that, but probably out of the back of a van is not where you should be buying electronics, you know, as a general rule. There are better venues for making those kinds of purchases, and it should be a sign that you've maybe stepped into something, you know, when you find yourself in a place and you might ask yourself, like, you know, why am I buying, you know, before you fork over the money, why am I buying what I have ever normally thought, like, if I was in the market for speakers, would I have gone out looking for white vans, you know, or something like that, or would I have gone to some other venue to try to buy the speakers I wanted?
Yeah. There is, though, isn't there that idea that when we are in a strange situation, or in a situation where we're separated from our community and separated from our support networks, that our desire to trust, our trustingness, like, for want of a better word, goes up. You know, if we're in a situation, you know, if we're on holidays, we feel like, oh, you know, I feel very uncertain. I've got to find people to connect with and trust. So sometimes those odd situations paradoxically make us more likely to make those kind of bad holiday decisions.
And it's only going to work in that sort of a context if it's something that you think, maybe I'm getting a deal here. Right? So you have to know enough that you want speakers, or you know, hey, you know, those sound really good and I've heard of this brand and, you know, I like high tech stuff. So, you know, that's going to make it that much more appealing. In the same way that if you fancy yourself somebody who wants to have art on your wall, right, and you know who Picasso is, right, and you see it at a cruise ship, and you have enough money to be on a cruise, and you have enough money to be looking at art on a cruise, you're the target, right? Because you're going to be looking at this and say, oh, wow, that's a good deal, and I know who that is, and, you know, maybe this is something that I can take home and I will have had a find, right? And that is sort of... That's part of the appeal is, you know, finding that target audience who's maybe a little bit eager and then selling it to them with a lot of detail.
I think you must go on classier cruises than I do, because I've never seen a Picasso on a cruise ship before.
Yeah.
I have a friend who works as a performer on cruise ships, and she sends me photographs of the art, and it is some of the most bizarre, horrific, like, art that I've ever seen in my entire, you know, like anthropomorphic olives jumping around and flaming playing cards and weird, like the sort of the real kind of Elvis painted in on velvet type art that gets sold.
I've never been on a cruise myself, but they sell that stuff in casinos in Las Vegas. There are art galleries inside casinos have all that crazy stuff.
Yeah.
But of course they're not advertising it. They're not selling it as though it's sort of like, you know, fine masterpieces, you know, and so on. A lot of it is sort of deliberate kitsch. And I think there's a whole, you know, buying a flaming skull t-shirt or something is a whole thing that you're supposed to do in Las Vegas. But that's part of why these things are so fascinating. Why would you think you can get a Salvador Dali on a cruise ship and that you're getting some great bargain when like 6,000 people must be boarding that ship every week or something like that? You know, like, this is not as exclusive as they make it seem. You need to really stop and ask yourself, ask yourself why you think you're getting a deal, I guess might be the way to summarize it. Why you think you've got a special opportunity. How special is it really?
Yeah. Why me? And what am I doing here? Is this realistic.
Yeah. You mentioned that idea of, you know, that this is, I think you said, like, this is what we do in Las Vegas, is that we buy kitsch art. Does that go back to that idea of prediction, almost expectations for your own behavior? It's like, I'm in this situation. What is expected of me?
I would say yes. I mean, I think that the social context often has a huge influence on our behavior, right? You do certain things in certain places that you don't do in other places. I think in terms of the framework that we go over in the book, I think expectations and familiarity are probably a big, you know, are probably a big part of that. And it definitely can have a huge, influence.
What do you suggest people do in that situation where maybe you have questions, but there's all of that pressure to not ask questions? I'm very much a question. I'll put up my hand and ask the question, because I'm, a little aggressive and like attention. But my wife, for example, is very non-confrontational and doesn't even want to ask questions in a situation which you're supposed to ask questions. What would you suggest someone like her does in order to?
But yeah, the social pressure is to not question, right? In some contexts. So if you're at a psychic performance, it'd be really awkward to stand up and say, "No, I think you're lying," right? I mean, you generally wouldn't do that, because there's a strong pressure not to do that. And that's going to be true in a lot of contexts like this, where you've got somebody who's kind of going through their sort of rapid fire sales pitch with lots of details, and you can stop and ask them questions. But if you're in a social situation where you are not supposed to ask questions, it makes it that much harder, right? If there are lots of other people who are just kind of nodding along, that makes it really hard to challenge.
I guess the number one thing I would say is, if you don't want to make a spectacle out of yourself, one thing you should always keep in mind is that they're almost never exploding offers. You know, like, those Picassos are going to be there on the ship next week. That money manager's fund will be there. Almost all offers that are worth taking are not exploding if you don't take them in the next, 1 minute, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 30 minutes, or something like that. Any offer like that, outside of, certain maybe job offers by very aggressive industries and so on, I think are just usually, things don't work that way. So just go away, think about it, do your research. Like, you have to open your mouth in front of other people, but there are other ways, I think, to try to get the information you need that aren't so, socially difficult.
Well, and part of the question is, part of the challenge in this is not necessarily asking questions of the person who's trying to scam you, although that's something you want to do, but you should be also asking questions of yourself. Right? So that question of, if I were looking for speakers, would I find the white van? If I were looking for fine art, would I go on a cruise and try and find their art gallery? Right? Probably not. So if you can ask that question of yourself, then you can kind of say, okay, I need to hold off here. This is a pressure tactic.
It does sound, though, that this is hard work. This is hitting the mental gym. This is like the idea, it would just be much easier just to be scammed. And in fact, I know a lot of victims of scams are scammed because it was easier than asking difficult questions.
Well, of course, if you feel like you're in danger or something like that, maybe paying the money is better than provoking something even worse. So I don't know what was going on in this situation, but certainly these kinds of interactions, right, could turn into interactions of a different nature than they seemed at first in some cases. Bernie Madoff was not, breaking anyone's kneecaps with the baseball bat if they didn't invest in his fund and so on like that. A lot of them are much lighter touch, than that. And I think, the option to do nothing is always something we should consider, very seriously. Like, there's very little reason to ever do anything right away, especially that involves, sending stuff of value to other people. Right. There's always time to do it later. If there's not actual danger, maybe there's, a chance to walk away. As far as the mental gym and the hard work, I mean, I think one thing that I noticed when working on this book with Dan is that there's so many great stories of scams, and they're fun to read and learn from. And it's not such hard work you know, to read about all these stories, but then at least just do a little extra thinking about how did this actually work? You know, what kind of patterns does it fit into? And, you know, what would I have done in that same situation? Right. And, you know, that's not that hard. You know, I don't think hitting the mental gym is, you know, it's not that hard.
Yeah. And there are a handful of just general principles that you can just have set up for yourself that, you know, if somebody calls and asks you to buy gift cards and read the numbers off to them, it's a scam by definition, right? It's a scam, but it's a really effective one. But if you know that, right, if you've read about a couple of these sorts of cases, then you'll know that if somebody's putting you under a lot of pressure and forcing you to stay on the phone and threatening you, but they want you to go buy gift cards, it's a scam, right? And that's...
Yeah. It does sound like in that example that there's two pieces of information there. Mm-hmm. One is you're under a lot of pressure, and the other is someone is asking you to buy gift cards. Mm-hmm. And they're both useful information, but it feels like that feeling of being under pressure and feeling rushed that's the important thing. Because once the gift card scam has gone and a new scam takes its place, they're still going to be using that feeling of pressure.
And you're not going to get rid of the pressure by sending them a couple of gift cards. Then they're going to say, oh, it turns out, you know, your balance was actually higher than we thought. We need you to go back and do it again. You know, so the idea that the pressure is going to go away if you just comply, I think, is an illusion in a lot of cases. A lot of these scams, they're going to keep it going, right? Mm. I mean, for as long as they can. So the pressure is not going away. That's if you realize the pressure is never going away. Yeah, if you realize the pressure is never going to go away, then that might give you a little bit more confidence to try to stop, you know, stop before giving in for the first time.
But you're right, though. They'll stop using gift cards, right? And they'll use something else, and there'll always be that pressure there, right? Because that's just a good tactic to get people, you know, worried or afraid, right? There's another scam right now that's really horrific. It's a kidnapping or injury scam. So it's a targeted scam. So they find people and they call and pretend to be somebody's kid or grandkid, typically a grandkid, and they're in trouble in some way, right? They need money right away. They've been arrested or they've been in an accident. They don't have money to pay. I mean, it's nonsensical stories, but there's a lot of pressure and there's a lot of fear, right? And it's using that exact same tactic. It's not asking for cards. It's asking for something else, but same idea, right? Putting you under a huge amount of pressure, making you think, oh, I should do something to help, right? And, you know, those are horrible scams, and they're preying, instead of on your desire for fine art, they're preying on your fear that something's really dangerous or bad has happened.
Well, so the book is Nobody's Fool, Why We Get Taken In and What We Can Do About It. It is on sale everywhere now. I've got copies for sale at the White
Van. But exactly, 330 pages with lots of fine print.
Yeah. By the way, the signatures are not ours on his copies. I just want to say that right now. We didn't sign those copies. So if you see the signatures, that's a tip-off.
I tried to get you to sign copies, but you quickly realized that it was actually, wait a minute, this is a power of attorney, not a copy of my... Thank you so much for being on Scammapalooza.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for having us.